Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Black lung disease, technically called co-workers pneumoconiosis, is caused by coal dust and, as it progresses, makes it harder and harder for coal miners to breathe. It was thought that black lung was a thing of the past, but a joint investigation by NPR, the Center for Public Integrity, and the Charleston Gazette has revealed that black lung is back and it's affecting younger coal miners more than ever before. I'm here with the WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson, and we're joined by NPR's Howard Berkus and Chris Hamby of the Center for Public Integrity. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
Erica, I'm going to begin with you because you have some clips of Howard and Chris's NPR piece that on this topic.
Yeah, I thought we'd start by just starting with where the story started.
The freshest indications of the resurgence of black lung are found in 24 autopsy reports, like the one on a coffee table in a gray house outside Nyoma, West Virginia. Each of its 8 stiff and stapled pages list one name in bold black letters: Quarles, Gary Wayne, age 33, cause of death, smoke, soot, and blast injury in the explosion 2 years ago at the Upper Big Branch coal mine. The details draw soft sobs from Gary Wayne's mother, Patty, whose pant leg hides a tattooed image of her son. But it's an entry on page 6 under significant findings that shocks the lost miner's dad.
He had black lung. Been in the mines for 13 to 15 years and already considered having black lung nowadays, it's unbelievable.
So here we have a 33-year-old man who died at Upper Big Branch already with black lung. Howard, what made you decide to start your story with Gary Wayne Quarles?
Because that's where my interest in black lung began, and because the autopsy reports from the Upper Big Branch explosion were really shocking when it came to the findings about black lung. 71% of the miners who had enough lung tissue for testing who died at Upper Big Branch had signs of black lung. Two of them were in their 20s, even younger than Gary Wayne Quarles. Several of them had less than 10 years underground, less than Gary Wayne Quarles. And for there to be that kind of occurrence of black lung, at least indications in the x-rays, for people with that amount of tenure underground and that age was really shocking to the black lung experts who've been following this for a long time. That's what piqued my interest, and that's when I started looking into it.
And so before we get too much into this, Chris, can you tell me a little bit about what black lung is?
So black lung, you would get that by... Miners get this by breathing dust in the mine atmosphere, basically when this large equipment chews through the coal and the rock, and it generates large amounts of dust. Now, they breathe this, and over the years, it collects in their lungs, and as it gets worse and worse, the lung becomes shrunken, shriveled, scarred, and black. It's tougher and tougher for them to breathe. And in the later stages, they have to choose between eating and breathing a lot of times. They're afraid to fall asleep because they are afraid they may not be able to get enough air. They have to sleep sitting up. One doctor described it to us as a diabolical torture to die of this disease.
And it's basically something that does kill the miner eventually, right?
If it doesn't kill them, there are complications with it. A lot of times it puts tremendous stress on the heart, causing heart failure. There are all sorts of other ways that you can die, but ultimately, yes, black lung has killed thousands of miners.
So in both of your reports, you talk about a resurgence of black lung. This is a disease that people for a long time thought was going away. There were drops in it. Just give me some background, either of you. When you say resurgence, what kind of numbers are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about a doubling of the cases of simple co-workers' pneumoconiosis, the basic level of black lung, as indicated in X-rays collected by the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health in the last decade, a doubling in the last decade, a quadrupling of the most severe forms of the occurrence of black lung in an area that includes eastern Kentucky, southern West Virginia, and Virginia. since the 1980s. So this is a significant increase in these occurrences. And I should note, by the way, that some of this should sound familiar to listeners in Louisville, because the Louisville Courier-Journal first talked about this phenomenon back in 1998 with an amazing series on black lung, and then a few years ago did a follow-up. And what Chris and I did was burrow down into some data that we were able to get from the Mine Safety and Health Administration, from federal records, that documented this phenomenon more, and also showed more about why it was occurring and problems that were occurring in the enforcement of the regulations that are supposed to control exposure to coal dust.
Well, and let's hear really briefly from one of the men you talked to, Mark McCowan. He is in Virginia, right?
Mark McCowan lives in Pounding Mill, Virginia, right on the West Virginia border. He's 47 years old now. He spent 21 years underground.
My name's Mark McCowan. I was diagnosed with a complicated form of black lung disease in 2005 when I was 40 years old. 14 months later, I took another X-ray and it progressed. After I quit work, the disease has progressed further to the worst kind now.
Mark McCowan is 47 now, and he looks healthy, just sitting there on his living room couch in Pounding Mill, Virginia. But walking his hilly yard, he says, or trying to mow the lawn, or simply holding his 2-year-old grandson leaves him gasping for air.
I say, little buddy, I got to put you down for a few minutes. And he's learned to run a little bit. He'll say, run, Papa, I'll run. He wants me to chase him. And I can't. I said, give Papa a minute. I might be able to in a minute. And I face Mount Everest every day. Sometimes I make it to the top, and sometimes I don't.
And so you can even hear him, you know, struggling for breath in that little bit of sound.
You know, Erica, we sat with Mark McCowan for probably 3 hours, and the interview itself was tough on him. By the end, his voice was raspy. His breathing was much deeper. But we walked away from that interview sort of struggling for breath ourselves. You can't help but suddenly become conscious of your own breathing when you hear Mark McCowan struggling for breath. And you know, he's counting the days. His biggest hope is that 2-year-old grandson he talked about, that Mark will live long enough so that his 2-year-old grandson will develop enough of a memory of him that he'll be able to remember him.
And Chris, you did some of your reporting here in Kentucky. Can you tell me a little bit about the Markham family?
That's right. I focused much of the piece that I did on a family of miners. The patriarch is Ray Markham, who's 83 now and has been drawing benefits for black lung for about 30 years now. He worked in the mines in a different time, a different era, when there were no real dust controls. The environment was much different. The 1969 law was supposed to have changed this. It was supposed to have implemented the first dust controls. And the idea was ultimately that black lung would be virtually eradicated. Of course, Ray Markham doesn't have to look very far to see that that hasn't happened, because all three of his sons went into the mines, started working after these controls went into effect in 1969, and all three of them have black lung today. One of them has the most severe form at age 51. He already has the most severe form and has had 8 pieces of his lungs removed. The other one, the youngest, at 50, is at the most severe stage of the simpler form of the disease, and his doctor has already discussed with him putting him on oxygen, and this is at age 50. And then the third brother is comparatively more fortunate. He has a lesser form of the disease, and he's 59. But, you know, the doctor who evaluated them said to me, you know, this should not happen. There should not be men like this today.
Well, and so this 1969 law, I mean, a hard-fought law, like you said, was supposed to protect coal miners and was supposed to get rid of black lung. So what's gone wrong? What happened here?
Well, what happened is a couple of things. One is the law wasn't terribly strong to begin with. It contained loopholes in which mining companies could essentially negate a violation issued by the Mine Safety and Health Administration for a failure to limit coal dust to federal limits by taking five additional samples. The mining company itself would take coal dust samples, coal mine dust samples, and then be able to average them. And what that was able to do is you'd have a coal mine, maybe two coal miners exposed to excessive dust, but then you'd have three others who weren't. And you would negate the fact that the two who were exposed, and the violations for that would disappear. And Chris analyzed data that we obtained from the Mine Safety and Health Administration on that. Chris, do you want to mention what you came up with?
Yeah, so when you look at the dust sampling database, which we had to obtain under the Freedom of Information Act, what you see is that from 2000 to 2011, there were 53 individual valid samples that indicated that a miner, 53,000 samples that indicated a miner had been overexposed, had been exposed to too much dust. And then you look at the violations that were ultimately issued, and there were only 2,400 during that time period. So you compare the 53,000 to the 2,400. Now, that's largely a result of the fact that what Howard was describing, a large number of those overexposures are simply just going to go away by the fact that you're averaging five samples.
And so a coal operator could hypothetically be perfectly legal, be following the law perfectly, and still miners would be exposed to these unsafe levels.
Oh yeah. The law permitted overexposure and underreporting.
But
it didn't end there. What we also found was this, what appears to be a widespread gaming of the system by coal mine operators, where when they do conduct their own sampling of coal mine dust, the devices that are used, they're called dust pumps, to measure coal mine dust, they're supposed to be hung on the miner as the miner is working, you know, at their station. And wherever that might be, at a mining machine or wherever. But what we found is that there are many, 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 many cases of dust pumps being hung in clean air returns instead of at the coal face, or in offices, or in lunch buckets.
Howard, we're up against a break here. We'll let you continue right after the break. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Heller. We're talking about the resurgence of black lung in the Appalachian coal fields with Howard Berkus from NPR, Chris Hanby with the Center for Public Integrity, and WFPL's Erica Peterson. And Howard, sorry to interrupt you a while ago. You were talking about some of the testing procedures that are in place.
Well, the point I was making is that there has not been honest sampling of coal mine dust by all mine operators, and that there has been a significant fraudulent sampling of mine dust, so that even though there was a legal way, you know, to avoid accurate sampling, coal mining companies also engaged in illegal ways of sampling dust. In fact, close to 200 mining company officials and contractors were prosecuted for that, and at least through 2002. So it's a system that was not geared to accurately measuring coal mine dust and not geared to really preventing the kind of exposure that causes black lung from the very beginning.
Well, and I want to play really quickly this clip from your second piece in the series, which I thought does a really good job to show kind of the steps operators will sometimes take to get around these requirements.
Richard Allen was a federal mine inspector underground in West Virginia when the new law first took effect. He remembers a strange question about a mine official's office, which revealed bogus sampling for coal dust.
What color is the man's carpet? It was blue, and it was showing little blue fibers in each sample. And they cross-referenced the fibers in these samples to that carpet and found that he was sampling in his office.
Mining companies and federal inspectors put sampling devices called dust pumps on miners underground. But almost every miner we talk to tells of dust pumps tucked into lunch buckets or under clothing or out in clean air returns away from coal dust. That's where a company foreman told David Neal to hang his dust pump when he worked underground in West Virginia in most of the 1980s.
And then we'd come back and they'd say, well, you might want to wear that, you know, for about a couple hours and I'll come and get it. And you wear it for a couple hours, and then they'd come and get it and take it, put it back over in the clean air. You know, maybe if we didn't do it this way, they'd come in and shut the mines down. And then we'd be out of work.
And that's obviously a common sentiment in the coal fields that if, you know, if a miner speaks out about safety or health issues, the mine will shut down. You know, even if they don't lose their job, the mine will shut down and they won't have a job. So now we're getting to the final couple of minutes here. So we've got laws that have loopholes. We've got operators who aren't following the laws. Can one of you talk a little bit about some of the factors you discussed in your stories that that are making miners exposed to more dust?
I think, well, one of the important points here is the geology of the eastern Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia, the central Appalachia region, is that they're increasingly grinding up more silica into dust, which is found in rock that surrounds the coal. So over the years, the big, thick seams of coal have been essentially mined out. So now the operators are going after these thinner seams, which means that they're cutting more and more rock. Now, when they grind up this rock, that means miners are breathing more and more silica dust, which is more toxic to the lungs than the coal dust is, actually, and can cause faster progressing disease like what doctors are seeing. And then at the same time, you've got the more powerful equipment, which can generate more dust more quickly, can cut through more rock more quickly. It can make seams more accessible. And then you've got longer work hours. Miners now are working more than they used to. 10 or 12-hour days, 6-7-hour weeks are now common. And so, you know, those two things working in conjunction, I think, explain a lot of it.
Anything you want to add, Howard?
Well, no, that's really what it all amounts to is there's more exposure given the longer work hours and longer work weeks. There's more toxic material that miners are breathing. Nothing that, you know, respirators haven't worked well for miners. There's really no magic bullet that has come that has been developed. And so it all comes down to the regulations. And if the regulations aren't robust enough to begin with, if they're not enforced well enough, and if there isn't enough of a crackdown on mining companies that violate the regulations, then you're going to have what's happened, which is 70,000 coal miners dead from black lung since 1970, $45 billion spent by the federal government and industry since then on compensation. That's a huge death toll and a big bill to pay for something that was supposed to have been controlled starting in 1969.
Well, I mean, and obviously you know this through your reporting on Upper Big Branch, Howard, but I mean, even when with other mine safety laws, you know, making sure that coal operators do follow the laws and, you know, and MSHA's enforcement is a huge, huge task with, you know, with mines all over the country. And I mean, so what's it going to take putting a federal mine inspector in every mine at all times to make sure the laws are being adhered to?
Well, you know, Mark McCowan, the black lung patient we heard from a little earlier, that's his solution is, you have mine inspectors there all the time watching how much coal dust is produced and watching the testing of coal mine dust, the sampling. He also suggests that every mine in the country go through some sort of a process in which you determine what is the reasonable production, maximum production that would take place in that mine, and what would also generate excessive levels of dust, and then that mine would have a standard based on that mine of production, and mine inspectors would be there to make sure they don't overproduce and overexposed. But the Mine Safety and Health Administration has already told us they don't have the resources to have mine inspectors doing that kind of detailed work. They don't even have the resources for mine inspectors to take over the inspection process themselves when it comes to testing for coal dust. So and sampling for mine dust. So, you know, unless they get more resources, I'm not sure anything's going to change. There is a rulemaking that's proposed by the federal agency, but it would still permit this kind of self-policing that has been abused in the past.
What stories did either of you hear that didn't make it into your final pieces?
You mean in terms of miners?
Yeah.
Oh, there's so many. You know, we spoke with a number of miners, and it's just heartbreaking how their lives are ruined, how retirements planned, you know, trips to, you know, to the tropics with the wife, you know, that they've planned for decades as part of retirement. They can barely get out the front door now. They can't mow, you know, people can't mow their lawns. They can't hold their grandchildren, like Mark McCowan described. And these are not old men in terms, you know, we're not talking about 70 and 80 and 90 year old coal miners. We're talking about 40 and 50 and 60 year old coal miners. It's just absolutely tragic.
I think one of the most heartbreaking things for me was one particular miner, David Neal, who lives in West Virginia, who is actually still driving a coal truck, but he's out of the mines, but he has black lung. He's in his early 50s. And you know, has all these plans for eventually getting out, moving south, becoming an electrician, and just talking with him and his wife, you see that they have these ambitions for the future. And then you ask them, where do you think that you're going to be in 2 years if you've got this advanced form of the disease? And it's almost heartbreaking to see the reality set in their faces.
And that's going to have to wrap it up for this segment on the resurgence of black lung. I want to thank Howard Berkus of NPR, Chris Hanby with the Center for Public Integrity, and WFPL's Erica Peterson for joining us to talk about this. Thank you all very much.
You're welcome.
There's more information.
Thanks for having us.
And you can hear Howard's and Chris's reporting and read it. A link to that is at our website, WFPL.org. Again, thanks to all of you for joining us.